Right,
with Harlan Coben, class of 84, with my close friend James Bradbeer, also class of 84, and we're going to be talking books in Amherst. Betsy, are you here too?
I'm here too. Betsy Cannon Smith,
also class of 84. So we have three class of 84s, and we've all known each other since freshman year, so this should be kind of fun.
Looking forward to it. Good to talk books on a beautiful summer Friday morning. And how is that book doing, my young friend?
All right, well, the newest one, 6 years, is doing it's doing great. It's been actually my biggest seller. It's been a ton of fun. Just finished all of the road work on it, and now, as is my want, I have to write another book. Unfortunately, I never get to sort of relax. And I treat it like a job. So that book's in my past. Once the book comes out, came out March 19th, I do a week or two of traveling and promoting it. And then I have to kind of put it behind me and forget about it and try to move on to the next one and really focus on it.
Well, we heard, and we're some of your old friends, but we hear you have some new friends as a result of this 6 years book. There's some fancy people interested who read it and enjoyed it?
Yes, Brad. Wow, that's subtle, huh? We'll see what. As always with Hollywood, we keep fingers crossed, toes crossed, and still don't believe a word anybody ever says. But right before 6 years came out, Hugh Jackman read an advanced copy of it, and he would be, I think, quite perfect to play Jake, the lead character in this, who happens to be a professor at a Western Massachusetts unnamed college, a political science professor. But he does go to Judy's restaurant in Bar Salati's. But we won't.
Yeah.
The college is not named Amherst, just so we're clear on that.
So Harlan, you say you put the books in the past as soon as they're written, and you move on to the next thing. But let's talk about the past a little bit, both with regard to this book and where some of those ideas came for this particular book. But also, this book is dedicated to Brad, and so tell us a little bit about that and the character, not present in this book, of Brad, but in many of your other books.
Well, when I created my series character, Myron Bolitar, I always loved in fiction the buddy-buddy or the partner. From Sherlock Holmes and Watson, be it Spencer and Hawk, be it Batman and Robin. I always loved, even be it that horrible Running Scared with Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal, I always loved the buddy-buddy kind of a thing. And so I wanted Myron to have a sidekick. And so I asked myself, what kind of sidekick did I want? Well, the kind of African-American urban tough had been done. The computer weenie that can look up anything on the Internet had been done. All those sort of things had been done. And I started thinking about my college roommate at Amherst, Brad, who's right here in this room. And I hadn't really seen that done, where when I first got to Amherst, the very first day I was in Amherst, this is an absolutely true story. We had, in those days, they were called Facebooks, but they were a different thing. Betsy, you remember our freshman Facebook.
Yep.
And we all studied them like they were the Talmud. Remember that first week of school?
Right, where they're
we would
from,
go
what
through
they
them
look
and
like.
And I remember, I'm a Jew coming up from a public school outside of Newark, New Jersey, and my dad and I are going through the book, and there's a picture of James Biddle Bradbeer the 15th or whatever the hell Brad is in the Episcopal Academy. And the only way I can describe this blonde hair, this haughty look on his face, the word I would use is using all of my literary knowledge would be punch-worthy. You looked at this picture, and you just wanted to punch this guy right in the face. It just looked like he had just walked off the Mayflower asking for a tea time. You know what I mean? And just everything I kind of hate. And I remember saying to my dad, literally saying to him, I go, look at this guy. I go, I won't even see him in my 4 years here, nonetheless be friends with him. And Brad and I met first night of orientation, and basically we're inseparable from, right? Am I right, Brad?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great Amherst story. And I'd gone to school with kind of a very singular profile. We were 60 white males, all kind of from a suburbia, and arriving at Amherst was, was really an eye opener. But immediately, Harlan, you were an interesting, really, really interesting person. We hit it off from moment one outside
now,
of Philadelphia.
Interesting. What did that mean back then, Brad? In terms of what was interesting?
Well, you know, I think my thing with Harlan was always that I grew up in a very sheltered world. You know, my world was, you know, I talked to my dad about, you know, sports, and, you know, we didn't talk about life. And I met this guy who, you know, like he had posters of J.R. Richard on his wall, and he talked about Woody Allen and Woody Allen movies, and he knew about this radio show with this guy and her sidekick, and his name was Howard Stern, and Harlan knew all this stuff that, you know, and he talked about politics and religion and I just, it was interesting. He was an interesting guy, and he was a basketball player, and he was great fun to go out with, and, you know, and those early days were, I mean, they were, I mean, that's what that place is all about. It's such a special place because you get to go and cocoon up there for 4 years, you know, and meet really interesting people and talk about really interesting things and build bonds that last a lifetime. You know, not to be too sappy here, but, you know, it really is. It was cool and totally unpredictable. I mean, there's Harlan's right. I don't think if I'd looked at it as a Facebook that I think his picture, you know, the afro, his hair was so tall, it barely fit in the picture, was my recollection of your image.
Not a problem anymore.
Yeah, you know, right. I mean, people see him now, like, oh, you mean the bald guy? I'm like, that's not really how I remember him. But, you know, he was a really interesting, he had these really cool parents. His mom and dad are some of my favorite people. I only met him, you know, unfortunately, just more than a couple handful of times, but they were just really interesting. He had interesting brothers who I'm still friends with today. I mean, he was interesting, and
that part was the different world. But I've never been one, and Brad hooked on to that pretty fast. I've never been good or like superficial conversations. I'm not good at like a big party where we're, you know, we're asking about each other's kids, because, you know, you don't really care what my kids are doing. I don't care what your kids are doing. I like to kind of get at the heart of life. I mean, we, you know, even when Brad and I are talking, we love each other's kids. We know each other's kids well. We both have 4 kids, and our kids love each other, thank God. We vacation together a lot, and it's wonderful because we don't see the kids. The 8 of them are just off, and they're gone and doing their own things, and they love each other. But, yeah, you know, I want to hear what team the kid's playing on, and then let's move on. And so I've always been better with getting into, you know, and Brad and I still to this day have these sort of long philosophical debates on the state of the world, how things have changed, how our viewpoints have changed from our days of college. And even back then, that's always the kind of conversation that I like. I'm not one for, you know, sitting here talking about, you know, the old Woody Allen joke, boat basins. You know, I don't really care about that sort of thing. I don't really care about the weather. So I don't do great in cocktail party settings. I prefer to sit down with more than one person, but and really go into it in more depth. And that's also what I love to do when I'm trying to write. Those sort of, I try to give each person these philosophies. I might write fast moving thrillers, but every person in it has a worldview, not always mine, oftentimes other people's worldviews.
I think that's, you know, part of his success, and it's fascinating when you're in it, because, you know, his writing kind of was our college shtick a lot. Just the, you know, his voice is really unbelievably clear. And, of course, it's the voice I listened to for 4 years. So it seems like the most natural thing in the world to me. And I'm like, people really want to listen to that? Like, you really? They think that's interesting? We thought that was interesting, but I can't imagine anybody else would. And but, you know, I do think, I think really his genius in his writing. I think I always like your stories. But when I talk to people, they love your story, but it's the ability to be incredibly topical. I always thought Harlan was unbelievably up on, you know, he was in front of where the world was, and always just slightly so, which, of course, I'm in the fashion world, so being slightly ahead is a really good place to be. You're not way, way ahead. You're not 10 years out, so that people have no idea what you're talking about, but you're also not behind. I think you're incredibly topical, and your writing reflects that, and people really like that, you know, the mix of funny and serious, but interesting. You're always, whatever the book is, invariably, you know, the sidebar is you're dealing with, you know, I mean, Harlan's the guy who wrote about, you know, the NBA MVP who had AIDS, and he wrote that before the Magic Johnson thing went down. I mean, that is just,
right.
Like, you got to be kidding me, and somebody would say, well, that's luck, and I mixed on luck. I just think he's incredibly intuitive in reading how the world is evolving, and that's, again, that was part of why I liked him that first day. He was interesting. His mind, he's on it, and he's interested by it, and that's what Amherst taught us, right? Amherst taught us to be, you know, curious. Like, what is this? What does it mean? Why should we pay attention to this? And I'll always be grateful, because it definitely, I did not grow up in a curious world, and I've moved to that. Personally, I've definitely moved to that place. I think the world is a really interesting place, and you have to go out with that open eyes and, you know, figure it out. So anyway.
Brad, I love what you say about Harlan's voice, because, Harlan, your voice is so present in your books, and anybody who knows you and was at Amherst with you and other places sort of feels like you're sitting on their shoulder shouting the story into their ear, but in a really comforting way. And what I'm interested in from the two of you, Brad, how does it feel to have yourself sort of characterized, portrayed in these books as Wynn? And then, Harlan, how reflective of your relationship, your real-life relationship, do you think the relationship is in the books? I mean, it seems pretty true to me, but I wonder how you think about that.
I mean, the Wynn thing is crazy. It's crazy. I mean, the number of people who, you know, get me, it's like people ask me, you know, in the company, you know, hey, did you know you have a store in Palm Beach? You know, really? Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I did know that. They say, hey, did you know you're Wynn? Like, boy, it remind you, that Wynn character really reminds me of you. I see you getting mentioned in the books, and it's amazing. People are very tapped into it. And, you know, Harlan has an unbelievable following. And, you know, when he introduces me as, like, you know, to somebody, this is a guy who inspired Wynn. I mean, people look at me like I'm a rock star. I mean, it's a little strange, right? I mean, it's a very odd thing. I mean, we have a story that I went up to see him sign a book 2 years ago. And, you know, he was launching his book, and I sat in the back. And he said, by the way, you know, the Wynn character is in the building. And unfortunately, you know, I was sort of wearing my, you know, lily tie and suit and all that. And so, I mean, I ended up signing as many books as he did.
I did, which got me angry.
All these people
brought the book up to get me to sign, you know, whatever. What did I sign? I can't remember what I
signed. You signed it Wear Pink, because you're promoting Lily. You signed it Wear Pink.
I was like, I get a little plug in there while I'm at it. But, you know, I
Well, he was wearing one of his lily ties, a blue blazer, khaki pants. I mean, he couldn't have dressed more for the part if I had asked him to.
Yeah.
So as soon as I mentioned, every time I do a Q&A, the first question I always get is, what's the deal with Wynn? You know, is Wynn based on a real person, whatever else? And I said, I tell a sort of a quasi-amusing story, and I'll tell you the real story in a minute. But Brett happened to actually be in, and it said, and he happens to be here. It took him about 4 seconds to figure out who he was.
Yeah.
And then he had a longer line, you know, than I did to sign books.
It was really, I mean, it's really, and it's funny. It's a great, you know, tribute really to Harlan and the power of the characters that he creates. I mean, people have an unbelievable connection. It's a huge deal when people find that out. I mean, you know, I'll never be an actor, you know, but, you know, I always, people sort of gawk at an actor and sort of wonder, are you like that? Right? Everybody asks me the same. They lead with, are you really like that? You know, I mean, do you really kill people at night? You know, it's a little like.
And the fictional part is Wynn in the books is a really cool, very tough killer, and Brad can't fight his way out of a wet paper bag in real life. That's the one thing I say. But, you know, this is sort of interesting Amherst College observation. While I didn't create Wynn till about 1993 or 94, I think, when I first started to write the Myron books, I actually think he was probably created in about 81 or 82. There was a time when we were at Amherst, and I remember it was Chi-Fi at the time. I don't know what you call Chi-Fi now. So we were in the basement of Chi-Fi. And Brad was on the golf team and had not played well that day and was a little bit grumpy about that. And I look over across the room. I'll never forget this. This is it. And Brad is going toe-to-toe yelling at maybe 26, this guy at the time, maybe 28, the defensive coordinator of the football team, a guy about three times his size and could probably break Brad in half. And Brad is basically almost challenging him to a fight. And the guy can't believe it. Brad is, like, in his face screaming. And I'm literally thinking, oh, my God, Brad is a dead man. And I remember routing over and kind of grabbing Brad by the scruff of his neck and pulling him away before this coach killed him. But I could not believe his bravery. This coach was making fun of him in a negative way, and this coach is long gone from everybody's lives, thank goodness. I won't mention his name, but some of you will know who he is out there. And Brad, like, I'm literally holding Brad back from, and I'm thinking, wow, how psychotically brave is Brad that he would just get killed if I let him fight? And what I also realized about my own reaction to seeing Brad was that there was kind of a stereotype and prejudice against a guy named Brad. Now, obviously, you know, as a Jew, I suffered plenty of that, and I'm not comparing it to what Jews or African-Americans suffer, but people hated Brad on sight, you know, that haughty, blonde-haired, punch-worthy face that you just wanted to hit. And so I said, what would happen? A character like this who was picked on because of this and had the resources to really learn weapons and martial arts and just make him a little bit psychotic and just a little bit willing to go there, and all of that kind of mixed together to form the character of Wynn. Of course, it's hyper-reality. I mean, you know, I have all the time in the world to think of the line. In this world, you know, Brad and I are both married with four kids living in different cities. In the world I've created, Myron and Wynn are both single guys who for a while even share an apartment with all the money in the world in Manhattan. So it's hyper-reality. That world doesn't exist, but it's not that far off either. Does that make sense, Beth?
Yeah, absolutely. And you've spun off a little bit of the Myron Wynn story into some young adult fiction. So you want to talk a little bit about that?
The thing is that, you know, fiction today, and I think it's a positive thing, in the days of Hercule Poirot or Sherlock Holmes, the characters never really aged or changed, and what happened one moment doesn't really affect what happens to them the next. They're just sort of solving cases. And that really doesn't play well today, and it really wouldn't interest me. So when I started the Myron and Wynn books, Myron was about 28 years old. Now he's over 40. The things that Wynn did that was kind of cute when he was 28 are sometimes a little sadder. There's a little more gravitas on these guys after 40. And that also means that the series does have a time when it's going to have to either stop or really it changes a lot. So one of the things I did was when I met Myron's nephew, who was only 15 or 16, I decided to spin him off into his own series and let Myron be the old uncle. And Wynn and Myron will both end up being in these books eventually, though I don't know how many of them I'm going to write. I never planned. But that's kind of the fun of when you have a series like this where the characters age and change, is you can kind of follow them. I mean, some people get a little bummed out. They're not as fast and as strong as they were a number of years ago. But that's, you know, that makes it, I think, as a writer and as a reader, hopefully more interesting to experience.
Harlan, have you heard much from other Amherst folks on this particular book, and perhaps any professors at the college or folks who see echoes of themselves in the book?
Well, I actually haven't, to speak to some, but a lot of the teaching philosophies, just to fill people in, 6 years is the most current book, and the lead character is a professor at a fictional version of Amherst College. I don't really fictionalize it that much. In fact, when I wrote the first draft, I actually called it Amherst, and then I did a search and replace. And I unfortunately named it something with an L, so sometimes the word "an" was in front of it, and I had to make sure I got rid of all of those. But I even had Judy's. I had the professors from political science from the Clark House. They're still in Clark House, aren't they, Betsy?
Yes, they are.
I even kept calling it Clark House. You know, I changed things around for my own sake because it is fiction. But the teaching philosophy was really mostly based on two professors that I had there who had this philosophy. One of whom actually specifically stated it, and that's Austin Sarrett. And the second one was Gordon Levin. Those were my two favorite professors while I'm there. Not to knock any of the others, I had many, many wonderful professors. But once I discovered those two, I basically took every course that those two taught. And one of the things that Professor Sarrett said from day one was that he didn't really care if you learned necessarily the specific philosophies or the readings. It was critical thinking, how to think critically, which I think is really what Amherst, I know for both Brad, because Brad and I talk about this all the time, don't you think, Brad, is really what, you know, if you were to put Amherst in two words, that's what, I mean, in one sentence, it is we are taught how to think critically, and that's the most
important
thing.
And open and curious, and keep going. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, so that was Jake Fisher, who's the name of my fictional I'm sure Austin Starrett would love to have Hugh Jackman play. but that philosophy was really what I wanted to give this character in terms of his teaching, that it wasn't necessarily, you know, I still remember specific. I think Christopher Lash was the first thing we ever read in one of Starrett's classes, and American Diplomacy with Levin, too, the same kind of thing. You'll remember bits and pieces of the specific readings, but what you more remember is how you apply it and how to think and tear it apart and support it.
I think learning to think critically, to be open-minded, and learn to write, I think that's the other thing. You know, I think it is kind of staggering. We were just talking last time we were together, you know, the quality of the writers that have come out of the circa 1984, you know, time frame that have had an impact in writing as a profession. You know, David Foster Wallace was kind of running around the halls with Harlan. Dan Brown was, you know, in the house.
Susanna Grant, who writes Aaron Brockovich and did a TV series. Bill Amon, the cartoonist.
I mean, it's pretty staggering.
Mark Costello was also there at the same time. Chris Bojalian, who does a new book out right now. All the same time in a school that has how many kids a grade? 450 a grade?
Yeah. It's kind of
and I'm missing a few. You know, off the top, those are just off the top of my head that were all sort of there at the same time between 82 and 86.
And I mean, even in the real, I mean, you know, I'm in business, but, you know, we hire aggressively in liberal arts because they can write. They can think and they can write, and everything else, you know, in the world can be taught. But if you're interested and you're curious and you can write and you can communicate, you know, you've got the great start. I'm still, you know, not to jump on the liberal arts bandwagon, but boy, you know, I've got kids coming into college age, and there's just, you know, I get a lot of questions on, you know, should kids be getting specific training at age, and there's a lot of press on that now, you know, the whole tipping point in excellence, and you have to do things over and over in order to get good at them, so you should start as early as possible. I just really, for me, I disagree. I think the ability to write and think is a big part of those 4 years, and we certainly had great access, you know, and it's like Harlan, people, like, he wasn't even an English major. You know, the story on Harlan and the book writing, from my perspective, was, you know, in the middle of senior year, when I'm not sure we were really cranking up the workload, you know, he kind of wandered into what was then called A dorm, where we were living, and, you know, and said, well, I'm going to go write a book now. we sort of said, well, don't get in the way of the TV on your way out, but, you know, go, knock yourself out. And he did. But he wasn't an English major. I don't think he planned to be a writer, but he was, you know, he's a really brilliant writer with an incredible voice. And, you know, I think it is remarkable the success he's had, not to brag on him a little, but, you know, he said something that, you know, it really struck me when we were, you know, out in the real world. The world is a very efficient allocator. And he gives a speech when he speaks and opens a book, and, you know, people always ask him, you know, well, you know, my book, you know, didn't get published, and it's this fault, and it's that, and I don't have big marketing. And the real answer is, well, you know, I don't mean to be a jerk, but, you know, I'm not sure the book's that good. And, you know, if it were good, you know, especially in today's world of the Internet, you know, customers and consumers find things that are good, and they find them more efficiently than ever, and he's just really, really good. His success is not luck. It's not any of that. It's just he's really, really talented, and he works his, you know, works really hard. I guess we've got to be careful with our language, but he works really, really hard, and he's really good at it. And I watch him, you know, we go away on vacation and run around and, you know, endlessly with his little notepad, you know, scribbling down something that strikes him, which I then see, you know, in the book, you know, whatever, a year later when it comes out, oh, yeah, I remember we were driving there, and I saw him write down that thing because something struck him funny. And, you know, it's really impressive. You know, I'm obviously, you know, proud of him and our relationship. But it's cool. He works his rear end off, and his books are really good, and they're worldwide. That's the other thing, Betts. It's, you know, it's amazing. Harlan's big in the States, but he's even bigger outside. The fact that our shtick is interesting in Finland. Like, I think you're the number, aren't you the number one guy in Finland, the number one mystery writer in Finland, or, yeah, I mean, some of these countries.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that, Harlan. That is an interesting phenomenon.
What do you think? I don't even know. Why do you think it works internationally?
I just got my 42nd language. So, relatively speaking, yeah, the books. My biggest country is France. I'm the Jerry Lewis of crime fiction. I don't really And, you know, I had a French movie made of one of my books that was a huge hit for them, and they did a great job and was critically acclaimed, and I can brag about it because, you know, I didn't make the movie, I just wrote the book. But in 42 languages, and the conclusion I've come to, and this is sort of an interview I just was doing about, because they were asking me about my friendship with Chris Christie growing up, there's something very universal in the specific. The more specific I am, the more I don't try to be every town USA, the more I try to write about being a guy from New Jersey, the more I make the college in 6 years like Amherst, not just any place that could be any college, the more universal the appeal. In the case of New Jersey, you see it with, say, Springsteen or The Sopranos or that kind of a thing. The more specific you are, when you try too hard, and I know Brad is the same thing, you know, Brad's clothing line, when he tries, and when people tell him, you know, do this because it'll appeal to more people, that's when he's dead in the water. If he's not specifically what it is, then they're gone. And so don't necessarily try to write something. I don't try to write something that's going to appeal to the masses. It may appeal to the masses. I mean, by judging by the number, yeah, it does. But I don't sit there trying to think, you know, most, you know, common denominator, all that. I have found that the more I stay true to myself and the more I try to stay specific, the more people will come to me. Right, Brad? Same thing with the clothes.
I think it's unbelievable. It's a huge, you know, finding. And, again, I think it's part of the liberty. It's counterintuitive, right? You have to have a mind that's open to working against the flow. And, boy, it's the most counterintuitive of all thoughts, which is the way to get broad appeal is to be incredibly narrow. Because everybody's natural instinct would say to be broad, boy, people are diverse, so we have to be diverse. And, yeah, our business has been very, when we get away from what we do really well, we get killed, you know, and it doesn't work. Customer doesn't get it. And the market's efficient for the best. And, you know, if you're the best, even, you know, it's a big world, so even if you're the best in a narrow slice, that's a pretty big, you know, pretty big cut. And I always thought, you know, you know, if it was just another Amherst or Dan Brown, you know, Da Vinci Code is a very specific book on a very specific, what would seem to be, you know, a narrow topic. And obviously it had, you know, incredibly broad appeal. And it's fascinating stuff. But I think that comes from our time on campus where we're taught to, you know, think critically because you got to be pretty sharp to come up with that finding that the way to become universal is to get narrow. Anyway.
Well, and you're mentioning lots of other people in Amherst Reads. Dan is going to be featured the month after you, Harlan, with Rick Griffiths from Classics, interviewing him with the Dante's Inferno piece. So Harlan, what's next? What's in your pen right now?
Well, the most interesting, I'm doing a ton of different stuff right now, but I think maybe the most interesting is that USA Network has just purchased the Myron Wynn to be a TV series.
Oh, cool.
I'm working on it with two people. One is Carol Mendelson, who created the CSI franchise, and a guy named John Gray, who was the creator of a TV show called Ghost Whisperers, and the three of us are going to be working on the pilot, and hopefully, you know, again, there's a lot of steps when it comes to TV. We're writing a 90-minute pilot right now for USA Network to turn Myron and Wynn into a TV series, which has always been one of the things. And now that I'm a little older, and when I was younger, I didn't really want that. I didn't want people to see and have a vision of Myron and Wynn in their own heads, and I do worry a little bit about that, but I'm working on that. I'm actually working on a British TV series, a French TV series, you know, working a little bit on the 6 years movie, though I don't really have too much of a part in that, and the remake of Tell No One, which was the French movie. But most important, I'm writing my next book, which is called Missing You, which if things go well, will be out March 19th, I think it is, of 2014. So I finished one, I start another, Bets.
No rest, always going.
That's it. Thanks
Great.
Very much for having us. And so,
okay, yeah.
Letting us reminisce and bore people to death, I'm sure, with, the,
yeah.
with our, I'm sure our kids might be, well, no, our kids wouldn't be interested in this. We'll find someone who may find this interesting.
Well, it was great to talk to both of you and hear some more of the escapades of 84. And thank you, Brad and Harlan, for providing some contents for all this.
Thanks, Bets.
All right.
Thanks, Bets. Enjoyed it.
Okay, you too. See you guys
soon.
Care.
All right, talk
Take
soon.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.